From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Please, 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 Minneapolis, this is the Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development. I'm Beth Korth, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice
games. And I'm Martha Croy, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are begging for money and quality of life. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start!
Beth, the face you made after that intro.
Dear listener.
That was perfect timing right there.
What happens if I go too fast? Go too slow, maybe.
Yeah.
It's going to be fine. Don't worry about it.
I was nervous.
And I would say, I'm a little surprised how well you did, but...
Wow, thanks.
I mean, just you set the bar, you set the expectations so low.
Yeah. That's how I do it.
It was a trick the whole time. She was always going to ace it.
Truly, though.
Yeah, yeah.
We all knew.
Also, I am noticing that we put our two topics for today put right next to each other. That tells a story.
It does. Yeah. I was thinking that as I read it.
Yeah. For listeners who missed last week, you'd be like, hey, what happened? Isn't it the Lydia era? And it is.
Still.
It remains the Lydia era.
Yes.
But she had a scheduling issue for today's recording session. Mm-hmm. So we've got Beth to join us once again this week.
Yeah.
She was with us last week to brainstorm some stuff that she and I are working on. It went great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have to say. So listen to that if you haven't already. Yeah, we got stuff to talk about, but what else at the top of the show?
Yes. Both me and Mark are asking for money outside of the podcast.
Right. We do. Please. Patreon.com/nicegamesclub.
Right.
But our teams are both doing fundraising efforts at the moment.
Yes.
Stevens is?
We're doing a Kickstarter for this game called Part-Time Hero. It's got a subtitle that's long, but that's part of the charm of it. We're asking for some money in order to get it in early access. Mm-hmm. So you can go, we'll have a link in our show notes so that you can go and see what the campaign is all about. But basically, a little synopsis of it is it's a deck-building game where you play as a magical girl who fights crime, but also has to pay rent. So you have to balance those two opposing things in order to survive.
The game has two modes. There's the life sim, get a job, make some money mode.
Yep.
And then there's the go out and, crush evil at night mode.
Yeah.
So it has a real charming, self-aware kind of, I would say it's lightly satirical
mm-hmm.
in a way that I suspect does not try your patience. It's it's really fun.
Yep.
It makes a point.
Yeah, yeah.
It's cool. It's I like it.
It's great. I'm really looking forward to working on this, but we need your help. So yeah, if you go to our Patreon.
You're just in seller mode.
Oh, I did. Yeah. So if you can go to our Kickstarter and just check out the game, that's all I'll ask. But also, if you give us money, that would be even better.
This is what you've been, for the past couple of months, you've talked about that thing you can't talk about.
Yes.
Because it was leading up to this is the announcement of the game, essentially.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's exciting. We can talk more about the game on the show now.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I am excited about that at the very least. Because, I've been trying to be a little bit tight-lipped about it because it's not my project to talk about in public.
Mm-hmm.
Now that it's out in the open, I can answer questions and things. Mm-hmm. So if you have questions, you can go to nicegames.club. Nope, that's not where you should do it. Just ask me on the Discord,
I guess. Too many places we tell people to go.
Yeah.
Check the show notes
for
the details. Unfortunately, the thing that I can't talk about that I've mentioned on the show before,
mm-hmm.
that is not what the team that I'm working on that is asking for money. It's the other team I'm working on.
Yeah.
Dream Settler. So I've talked about Dream Settler for a long time on the program because it's been in development for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And we are looking towards the content creation, kind of what we're calling the final stretch of development, which is a pretty vague term, I'll be honest.
Mm.
And so we started a Patreon for it.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that in my feelings on all of that in the topic we picked for today, which is just very timely for us.
Yes.
The begging for money topic. We'll get into it. But the details basically are we have a bunch of mini games in Dream Settler, and we have the page creation tools kit that I built, which includes a markup language and the sort of Microsoft front page alike to build pages in a WYSIWYG style.
Yeah.
And we're going to be providing that to patrons before the game releases because it will be part of the game release. But we'll part it so people get to play with it and kind of get a head start. And then Jay, who is sort of the lead narrative on the game, he's going to be creating pages as part of a regular stream that he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to have private Patreon chats and people can. So we'll have an audience of people who are familiar with the tool set. And then he's going to do a little bit of collaboration with folks. And so that's going to be part of his process going forward.
Yeah.
Which is nice for us. But also if you want sort of early access to some of our mini games, You'll get those as like separate executables.
Oh my gosh,
which is really fun.
For me, that's a big draw because
you played Plox.
Plox is so fun.
Plox is available now.
Yeah.
So the link for that will be in the show notes. And I will say, we do ask for money for this program,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to continue to do that.
Yeah.
You can't stop us. I'm sorry. I know you want to, but just speaking for myself, listeners, I don't think of you as the customers for my games. Mm. So if you want to support my team, if you want to back Steven's game, please do.
Yeah.
I backed Steven's game. If you have to pick one, that's the one I would recommend. Because Kickstarter is an all or nothing thing.
Yeah, and the game will not get made unless we get your help.
Yeah, so. Stakes might be a little bit higher, but yeah. Also, I just speaking personally, I supported it. I think you should too.
Thank you.
So just speaking as a person in the world, and you know, links are available.
Mm-hmm.
But the money we're going to ask you for is always going to be Nice Games Club money.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
Right.
I think the ask for this community would be not necessarily if you don't want to back it, but I bet you know somebody. Who should back it?
Yeah, please share it.
Please share.
Yes, good point, Beth. Mm-hmm. Yes, please. I'm nervous about self-promotion, but like, yeah. If you enjoy the show and you want to support us, I think sharing is probably a really good way to do that.
Yeah, for sure.
So yeah, those links will be in the show notes. Do we have anything else to talk about at the top of the show, or if we really dive deep into this topic?
Beth, you got something you really wanted to talk about on the show that you...
No, I'm interested to hear how you're begging for money.
I guess we're all begging for money.
I mean, because it has to do with Nice Games Alliance a little bit, too.
Yeah, we beg for money, yeah.
If I want to start making some more games, I'm going to figure out how to make some money. So let's talk it out.
Yeah.
Okay, so the first thing there's many different types of begging for money,
mm-hmm.
but we're phrasing it this way because we're talking about crowdfunding.
Right.
Right. I guess maybe let's just talk about Kickstarter because that's what you're dealing with.
Sure.
You know, we can talk about like what projects are good for, what are bad, but like mechanically, tell us about getting that set up. You know, you're part of a team that put it together.
Yes. So we decided on Kickstarter largely because we had been trying to get funding from publishers for the longest time, you know, ever since I've been there.
Yeah. On a couple of different projects.
And nothing has, for the most part, nothing has come of it. And so we wanted to just take it to the public because I think we were kind of just fed up with not getting any attention from publishers. Also, evidently, money is drying up in general in the industry is what I keep hearing.
Right.
So it makes it more difficult.
People are buying games left and right.
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 But they're not spending money to get games made, I guess.
Yeah. Publishers are shy
at
the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And so we just got fed up with it. And so we're trying out Kickstarter. The intention is it's actually like a lot to run a Kickstarter campaign because like you said, Mark, it is all or nothing. And so like a lot of the work in Kickstarter is just getting the word out and letting people know that this thing exists so that they could potentially pledge for it and help you get the money to make the thing. And so like I think that like certain not every project is it useful to make a Kickstarter for, partly because like when you're making a Kickstarter, there's a certain amount of things you do have to promise and you have to make it clear why people are backing your thing. And it can make it difficult because there were a few things that we had to like sort of rush decision wise in order to get this out the door. Cause like we actually hadn't decided on the name for the game until we made the Kickstarter. For instance, we're really happy with the name we picked. Now
I like it a lot.
Yeah, it's great. But we've been calling it something internally for the longest time. And you know, you eventually
what were you calling it?
Just Project Hero.
Yeah, that's fine. I guess.
Yeah, it's not really great. And like the game has changed a lot from what it didn't used to be, like a magical girl focused thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that partly made sense, but like as it changed, informed, we should have probably changed the name, but like other things took priority. And that just kind of happens when you're working on something. It's like there are other things that are more important, so you just don't think about the name until like you have to. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of nice that we had to do it, but like we did kind of have to quickly come up to a decision with that. And there were a few things with Kickstarter that we needed to do in order to get this to work. But I think ideally when you're working on a Kickstarter, you want to have a lot of lead up time before the campaign actually happens. You want to talk about it so people remember, people know when it's going to happen, so that they can anticipate it. And when it happens, they could have the money ready to help pledge.
Yeah.
In addition to that, a lot of times with Kickstarter campaigns, you get a lot of money up front because everybody who is really excited about it will be spending the money. And then you'll get like sort of a trickle effect after like the first few days because like everybody who was excited about it already spent the money. And everybody else you're getting are just like random new people that are hearing about the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
The money you're earning slows down significantly after a certain point. But once the campaign gets closer to the end, you will end up getting a lot more money because people are recognizing that they could get in. They can get in on the ground floor, I guess, now before the campaign.
You have all those people who saw it earlier.
Yeah.
Who are, you know, waiting till the deadline.
Right, right, right. Yeah. So it can be kind of, as we're sitting right now, the campaign has only been open for us for like 4 days. And so like right now we're kind of in the big spike in the beginning, but like it could be nerve wracking to watch the campaign over the 30 days, 60 days, however long you have it, to see how the numbers are changing. I'm like trying personally. I'm trying to like be, I'm like looking at the numbers, but not too much. Because if I look at the numbers constantly, then I'll just be. That's all I'll be doing. So I'm like trying not to be too nervous about how the Kickstarter is going. But that's kind of what we've been doing with it. I think that like there's a lot of logistical things that have to get in place in order to run a Kickstarter, especially if you're talking about like rewards that people can get for the Kickstarter and things. Like there are options to give out pins. T-shirts and physical things are difficult because there's all the shipping and stuff that you have to understand. We're working with a company called 86 that has worked with us in the past to make t-shirts and things, and they are helping us distribute that. But if we didn't have that in, it would be very difficult for us to do that.
Yeah.
But like, it's not just that. Like, we're also offering like digital soundtrack copies and things like that for the Kickstarter. All of that stuff kind of had to be figured out in advance to see what makes sense for the campaign, what made sense to give out to people, and what we could provide to people that would be interesting and valuable for people to see.
Yeah, I think at my pledge level, there's the game, but also like 4K wallpapers.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, that seems like something that, you know, you're making a campaign, you're like, yeah, we could do that, whatever.
Yeah.
But it sounds like what actually the team was smart enough to, like, before offering something that seemingly easy, actually decided we need to actually allocate resources to get things made. If not now, then as part of the production schedule.
Right.
It'd be really easy to overestimate what you can deliver because each little thing feels easy and then adds up way faster than you expect, right?
And part of our team has done a Kickstarter in the past.
Okay.
They did Indivisible, and that was a Kickstarter campaign. And that some of the things that I have heard about how the rewards and stuff were distributed after the fact sounds like it was a nightmare. So like we are working with some experience that we already have to make sure to avoid those kinds of pitfalls.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just helpful to like do some research on how other Kickstarters are doing it, like what they have detailed and the specifics of it and what makes sense for your game versus what other people are doing too. And lean into your strengths. Like we're leaning into our strong art group.
Mm-hmm.
In order to help promote the game.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I don't know. Is that? I guess that's kind of our Kickstarter stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the art pedigree of the team is highlighted in the text as well.
Yes.
And show there's tons of graphics and unique graphics, which is not always the case, right? People will put together icons real quickly, but there was a lot of work was done on that stuff.
A lot of work.
But also there's a bunch of, the video has a lot of gameplay. There's a bunch of GIFs in the description showing, and really showing off the work you've done assembling the
thing. Yeah.
Which is the first I've seen of it.
Oh, yeah.
It's really cool. And so that was kind of fun to see, like, oh, look, it's Steven's juice.
Yeah.
But I think it goes a long way towards people being like, oh, this is definitely getting made if it's funded, which is not always provides a lot of confidence. So I think it's it's a great example of a well put together campaign, I think. It's at 15% funded now, pretty soon out of the gate, which is, I think, pretty good to average for a successful Kickstarter.
Yeah.
But you're asking for a lot of money.
We are.
Let's talk about that.
we need a lot of money in order to get this game out there. I guess it was like a lot of discussions just to figure it out. What I suppose it's difficult. It depends on what your team is at with respect to like what they want for the Kickstarter. I think it's important actually really to just like be clear what this Kickstarter is specifically doing. And we've tried to be very clear about how this Kickstarter is helping get the game out in early access. You're not getting the full game, but we're using this money to get it to that point.
Mm-hmm.
So we can get it to early access. And so I think that it's important to like really ask yourselves what you need in order to do what you want. What are you actually doing with this money? And I think people need to hear that too when they're trying to pledge, because like they want to know what this money is getting used for.
Right.
Because otherwise,
how much money is it?
Let's say it again.
How much money is it?
Oh, 200,000.
Right.
Yeah. It's a lot.
It's hard to say out loud.
It is.
But here's the wild thing is, you know, you can pay four people very poorly with that amount of money.
Right.
And but there's more than four people at Future Club. So there's definitely a gulf between what feels like an objective, a lot of money for a campaign versus like actually funding an operation.
That's exactly.
For a time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I met, you know, we're not talking about a full year, I assume, before early access.
Yeah, no.
But maybe, you know. So it's tough because you, in order to ask for what you need, like it's a shocking number.
Yeah. And there was a period of time when there were a lot of like when video games were making a ton of money off of Kickstarter. And there were people like asking for peanuts, basically.
Yeah, that's for like $3,000.
Yeah.
They'd make 12.
Yeah.
And then everyone would be like, oh, it did so much better than... And then, of course, that's not nearly enough to make a video game.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
They'd get into trouble later.
Yeah, so part of the intention is for us to be honest about what we're looking for. Because like if we just ask for $10,000, like it's not enough to make... It's not what we need.
Yeah.
And it would be... irresponsible, to say the least, to like ask for that kind of money and have people expect to get something out of it in return.
Yeah.
So I think that's a lot of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff internally that I don't want to talk about.
Yeah, I think. Well, I'm gonna extract as much out of you as I can.
Okay.
You can extract as much out of me.
Sure.
But we want to broaden to talk about these topics generally as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
But first, breaking news, Beth. What are you doing with your credit card over there?
I apparently didn't have my credit card in my Kickstarter account, so I was just backing Steven's game.
Oh. Live on air.
Thank you. That's very sweet.
Inching ever closer.
Mm-hmm.
I love it.
Yeah.
So you're looking for publisher backing. Publishers are shy these days.
Yes.
And you're also not looking for full fund. You're looking for the early access is the goal here for this round.
Mm-hmm.
What other options do you, and maybe this is some speculation if you don't have full visibility into this from leadership, but were there other options you could have taken, do you think?
At this point, well, we've exhausted a lot of options. We weren't just looking at publishers. We were asking for funds. We were looking to see. I think part of it is like in order to keep the lights on, like you could do contractor work and things like that. And we just don't have, we don't know who to talk to get that kind of work.
Right, right.
And so I think a lot of times people will like do contract work to supplement their actual game that they want to make.
Mm-hmm.
But we're just not in that. We've gotten contract work here and there, but like we just don't have a good consistent resource for that.
Yeah.
So I think we just kind of felt like we did run out of options, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we decided we wanted to go to the Kickstarter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I suppose, you know, there's Indiegogo and other
platforms,
but when you decide to ask the, you know, like, let's just take it to the people.
Yeah.
Then that the Kickstarter is still the best option.
Yeah, and I think we also, because we have just more experience within Kickstarter specifically.
Right. There are quirks and whatever and blah, blah, blah.
There's
but independent of that, like, yeah, that it just becomes like a sort of obvious to do that at the stage you're at, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah. And we're hoping that, like, people like us and like our game idea enough that it'll lead to something. I think part of it also is just, like, we really want something of our own to put out there. We've been leaning on Skullgirls for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I can't speak for everybody on the team, but I know personally, I'm like, we should be able to do our own things at some point. I think being able to like make a name for ourselves in this way is really valuable too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of it as well.
All right. Do we want to talk about what I'm up to, or do we want to sort of talk about more Kickstarter-y things broadly?
It's kind of difficult because, like, I've only have experience doing Kickstarter for this game.
Yeah.
So I it's difficult for me to talk about it broadly.
Yeah.
And I wasn't the one who did a lot of the research on like other Kickstarter things. I just used a lot. Some of it was just gut instinct for me.
Well,
but other people on our team did a lot of research on how the Kickstarter should work.
Then let's do this. Let's be like Socratic amateurs. Like, let's talk about our own experiences as customers and our own sort of feelings culturally about Kickstarter's place in the game dev ecosystem. And the gaming ecosystem.
Yeah.
How many games do you think you've backed on Kickstarter?
Actually, that's an interesting question. I think I've probably backed like 3 games or so. Not a lot. And really just stuff that like when I had the disposable income, I thought seemed like really cool ideas and things I wouldn't see out there. Honestly, some of those games that I had backed, like they didn't reach the finish line. So like I got some of the stuff that I pledged for, but like I didn't get much out of it. Because like it does feel like Kickstarter is, it's not donation. Like people are expecting something out of it,
right?
But things can change over the period, over the time that you like after the campaign ends. And that can affect how the project goes. It's kind of difficult to predict as just somebody who's just outsider looking in, what makes sense to back, I guess.
Yeah,
you just kind of have to go with what makes sense for you, I guess. And you're like, oh, this thing looks really cool. I like it. I would like to put some money into it so that it can get made.
Yeah.
I think is the best way to approach it, really. Whatever makes sense for you and your budget.
Right, right. And I think, you know, Kickstarter puts the big warning. Kickstarter is not a store.
Yeah.
It's a store. Mm. Like, it's a liability shield, that's what it is. But when you do have to go in knowing that, like, maybe you won't get the thing.
Yeah.
And so that is a real thing you need to think about. But in all intents and purposes, that your purchase decision is very frequently based on the fact that you believe it will be shipped to you, which is how you make any purchase decision.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's people really don't, they say back, but they mean buy.
Yeah.
And that's just how it is. I wish we could be a little bit more honest about that at the platform level. But, I mean, as a creator, that liability shield does properly protect you to a degree. But there are all sorts of stories about games that don't get finished and just like it ruins those people's lives.
Yeah.
And it's like, but it says it right there. It's not a store, you know, but if that were true.
Yeah.
You know,
it can also ruin your reputation, too.
Yes. Yes. Right. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a great argument for asking for what you actually need.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
So I looked at my Kickstarter history.
Oh.
Because it's been around for so long.
Okay.
And
yeah, I guess that's
true. The first thing I ever backed was a Haley Bonner record called Golder.
Oh.
Which I didn't even realize was a Kickstarter project. I love that record.
Yeah.
Oh, but it's a long, long time ago. Mm-hmm. But then the second thing I ever backed was the Ouya.
Oh, yeah.
I was early to Ouya. I loved it.
Yeah.
That was how I started developing games. Rather, other than just like toying around on mobile or web or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a bunch of things in here I completely forgot were Kickstarters.
Oh, okay.
Abduction, which was the Cyan, you know, they made Myst.
Oh, yeah.
Abduction was their return to that genre.
Yeah.
With a brand new game rather than like a remaster or something. Mm-hmm. That was, I backed that. But I guess it was an era where like that was more common. It's video games is not as common on Kickstarter as they used to be.
No, they're not. It's right? Kickstarter is a really popular resource for board games.
Yes.
Now. And even that money, I guess, is drying up, I've heard.
Well, there's the GameFound is now where most board game campaigns live. So I think Kickstarter like lost that market, actually.
Oh,
but
okay.
But crowdfunding in board games is like, I think 70% of board games are go that route.
Yeah.
Even for publishers do it. Like it's.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Like our publisher that did Glom.
Yeah.
Their next two games were crowdfunded ones. But that's just a normal thing that publishers do in a way that like indie publishers and games tend not to do.
It
doesn't mean much more independent developers who do it. Hmm. Yeah, I have a couple of board games on here, but like the last actual video game I backed, I'm acting like this is a big list. It's not a huge list,
okay.
But Whisker Squadron, which was made by folks from the Midwest and a couple of people that I know. And I backed that, and I think it came out. I just forgot about it. But I don't mind. It's just a little money to some friends, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. Beth, Kickstarter history for you?
No comment.
No comment.
But
it doesn't mean it's a huge list or an empty list.
You'll just have to decide for yourself what you think.
Okay.
I think the important thing about that, though, is with anything, it's like we were talking about, Steven said disposable income. I like that because just because you're pledging something that may not get fully backed and then you may not have to pay for it doesn't mean that you shouldn't allocate that money as if it's spent.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of people who get really into Kickstarter tend to back a whole bunch of stuff. And then like if you don't even know, like I don't think you should back things just because it's there and it might be fun. Like you should actually want it.
Right.
Right. You do need to.
It's like you don't walk through Target and like pull stuff off the shelf just because it's there.
Right.
So why would you do that on Kickstarter? And I think there are people that do that. And I think that that's just one of the things that's important is you should know what your budget is and not pledge more than you can afford to pay.
Right. Right. Or, and then this is something that's true also of like Steam sales. People put their game on sale for $3 and they get a bunch of purchases from people who wouldn't have bought it and will probably never play it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, is that good for anybody?
Yeah.
You know, like thinking from the creator side, like is that fact that there's an audience out there who will just like kind of more blithely give away some of that disposable money, like then you get some of that money, but is that in the end also bad for them? Because then you get this like weird matrix of expectations and assumptions.
Yeah, and like I don't know, is that satisfying that like somebody spent $3 on your game and they're not even going to play it, so you didn't get that much money in the, to begin with,
right?
And they're not even interested in the game, like.
But it's $270 you wouldn't have had before.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
I think like for me, when I buy stuff on Steam, it's often a repurchase of something that I already purchased through some proprietary store or something, okay. And I lost the login, or I don't really want to support that specifically, like because it's hard to remember that password, and so it's like it just put all my crap in the same place.
Right. So very disposable income.
Very disposable income. Yeah, but I mean, that's why I buy them for $3, right? Like I'm not going to buy it for $60.
Right.
You put it on sale for $8. Yeah, sure.
I mean, that attitude is, I mean, there's many different ways to approach that, but like thinking about backing a project and thinking about it really has to be disposable income so that you don't care if it goes away.
Right.
Well, and also like there is like the whole liability thing. There is no guarantee if they get funded that that stuff's going to come.
Right. Yeah.
So like you should definitely hope that you get that thing for $20, $40 or whatever. Right. But like don't put down money for something that like you're really sad doesn't come.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Like,
but the culture is not that. Right?
No.
Like that's literally what it says, and everybody can point to it and say we didn't tell you any differently.
Mm-hmm.
But the culture around it from creators, from backers, and really from Kickstarter, the way that they promote the service is very much like you should. And truthfully, because high profile things that do well and get written about tend to also get delivered.
Yep.
So it's, so that expectation just builds from, it's not entirely like, you know, people, you know, winking at each other about it. It's it's because of people looking at empirical data on the subject.
Mm-hmm.
But that because you don't see a lot of the stuff that has the problems or makes its money but then never delivers, like that is a okay outcome as far as the technical sense of it is concerned. But you just don't hear about that. So you don't think that's going to be, you don't consider that when you're backing something.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's why you have to ask for what you need, so that because you don't put yourself in that position of being at risk of that.
Yeah, to not be able to deliver.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. It is helpful to have somebody in your corner who can do those budgeting things.
Yeah.
Numbers people are hard to find.
It's true. So, Patreon.
Yes. A completely different beast.
Yes.
If you back us on Patreon, we're not giving you the game.
Yeah.
I love that.
You're not getting,
that's the difference.
You're not promising it.
Yeah.
You're getting early access to things. You're getting demos. You're getting stuff. You're getting some, you know, private stuff. It's different, right? And I have a lot of like conflicting feelings about Patreon.
Sure.
So I'll talk about our situation with Dream Settler and why we went this route. So basically, one of our developers sort of had to check out of the process of the game for almost a year.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, for over a year.
Okay.
And I've talked about this a little on the show, and Jay doesn't mind. He's talked about it too. But basically, he just had to step away from the project for a long time.
Okay.
And so Mike and I were carrying it, and so we were just at lower capacity for a very long time.
Yeah.
And so the game just development has just gone on a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, the advance that we got from the publisher, a lot of that goes to pay me, and that's drying up.
Yeah.
But I'm under contract with the team. And so I'm not giving up that that.
Yeah, for sure.
And so that is still something that the project is obligated to. Now, I've said it to the team, and I'll say it here publicly. Like, if suddenly I stop getting paid, what am I going to do? Give up on this project I've been working for three years? Like, I'm invested. I have a stake in the back end. Like, it's creatively a third mine. Like, you know.
Yeah, for sure. No, truthfully. Like, I totally understand.
I'm in a position where, like, I could be taken advantage of in that sense.
Yeah.
But, you know, no one's expecting to do that. So, basically, the game is no longer directly funded. So, what's paying for the project, and that includes commissioning artists and designers to contribute assets, which has been a big part of the process. There's a lot of content in this game.
Right.
That needs to continue.
Uh-huh.
We were also hoping to bring on a narrative designer for a brief stint, but I think that's probably not going to happen now.
Oh, okay.
But I think we have capacity. We're okay with that.
Okay.
But that was part of the plan originally. But all of that is being paid for by revenue from Hypnospace, which is this game is the sequel to, and then Slayers, which was a spinoff that came out last year.
Okay.
And so that should be okay. And the thing is the money that I make is not a salary. It's not enough to live on.
Sure.
And the reason I signed that contract is because the game was going to be out, and then that's where I'd make all my money.
Yeah.
So basically, we have all three of us are in a situation where, like, we got to keep working on this thing. We got to get finished, but we would like a little bit of extra money to be able to, like, be comfortable continuing.
Yeah.
In the amount of time that we think we have left that we've now scheduled out. And so that's the sort of uncomfortable part of it, because we're dealing with the publisher. And what, honestly, what we really should do is we should be asking the publisher for an additional advance. We can negotiate terms on that. They can get a higher rev share on the early recoup or something like that. But those talks didn't really go very far, basically because we really couldn't make a case that things were so dire.
Yeah.
Because they're kind of not.
Okay.
And so we were thinking about various ways to do additional income. So Plox, the game that is part of the Patreon right now,
mm-hmm.
you played that at Playtest a little while ago.
Yes.
You really liked it.
So fun.
And we were thinking, well, what we can do is we can maybe sell some mini games that we have finished that are ready to go as separate projects.
Yeah.
And then we find an audience for that. But the thing is we would need the publisher to publish that, and they would take the cut, and they would have to promote it. And that's asking them to do a lot of work. And they didn't want to do that.
Okay.
And I think they should have done it, but I get their point.
Sure.
You know, it's basically asking them to solve a problem for us that may or may not see them a lot of revenue, because none of us know what projecting on an individual little thing would sell to fund rest of development. So yeah. We thought, well, if we try, we could do a Kickstarter mm-hmm. for the rest of the production thing. That would be fine, but that would cannibalize later sales.
Right. Right.
So the thing about your Kickstarter is it is sales. You're selling the game now.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. That is part of it.
But we didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
And so we thought, okay, a Patreon could work. But the thing about a Patreon is you have to convince people to give you money regularly. And that's going to be a smaller number of people, but it's also going to be asking for more money from those people.
Yeah.
And we needed to be really careful about, like, we need to make it very clear what they're getting,
yeah.
what it's worth it to them, and not exploit the sort of heavy anticipation for this game.
Yeah.
There's an audience of dedicated fans that are really waiting for this thing. And every time we release a little morsel of information, they're like super excited.
Yeah.
and I kind of have to respect their agency. Like,
mm-hmm.
and not just assume that if we ask them for money and they give it to us, that that's a problem.
Yeah.
But I'm
yeah.
very nervous about that, about like exploiting their interest.
Right.
Essentially.
I get that.
And so we came up with, like, this is what we're not going to do. We're not going to promise more than we can deliver.
Okay.
We also are not going to be doing extra production work.
Okay.
To provide assets, because then that would be basically spending the money we're getting.
Yeah.
Just mm-hmm. to, that's, Kickstarter's getting to that problem a lot. It's like, right. suddenly it turns out it costs a lot to ship pins from
yep,
overseas.
Exactly.
And then you don't have a lot of money left over to make your game.
Mm-hmm.
So we came up with a plan where, and the thing about the game is that so much of it is ready to go and done, and we want to show people.
Yeah.
And so we thought, well, what if we, Plox is ready to go, we can release that as, you can just give it to people who sign up for even a month. That's a proxy buy in a sense, but not so much. And the publisher said, like, yeah, we don't need a cut of that, don't worry about it. So they're,
okay.
you know, as much as, you know, we had back and forth, like, we didn't, you know, we had, took forever to come up with a plan. They've been super cool about where we ended up, in a way that, like, they could have been a little bit more circumspect about, like, hey, you're profiting off the thing that we funded earlier. Like,
yeah.
So they've been cool in that sense. Mm-hmm. But also the like I said at the top of the show, the framework that I'm building for page building, that's going to be part of the offer as well. And that, I think, for fans, I think people are really excited about that, which makes me feel good, because that's
good.
You know, this audience has existed that was built from Hypnospace Outlaw.
Yeah.
It was a hit indie game. I've been on the team for the sequel for 3 years, but like, I don't really feel like any of those fans are my fans.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And I've never felt comfortable feeling like I've earned that audience in any real sense. And so I'm finally getting to give them something I made, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Especially as the game is, the production schedule has gone a little further than I thought. But the main thing is this, the biweekly streams where Jay is going to be doing content creation. And so all the extra labor that is involved in creating content for the Patreon is going to be on him.
Okay.
And that's him recognizing that he was checked out for a long time. And so he's picking up as much of the slack as he can.
Cool.
So that's really cool. But also that's something he's excited about. He feels it's going to really help his process.
That's great.
He did something similar in Hypnospace Outlaw, which okay. was pretty good. He likes bouncing things off of people. And so people who are part of those streams and will be part of the sort of private Discord or, channels, they will have access to the tooling, so they'll be better rubber ducks and sounding boards for
you. Yeah.
Without, I hope, feeling like they're, you know, they're paying to beta test or
yeah.
paying to contribute to the thing. We're trying not to make any promises about, like, you can make your own pages and you can send us your ideas, but like, we're not charging you to be part of the team. Like, that's,
this isn't spec work. Yeah.
Yeah. I would feel very bad about that, and
yeah.
I will be honest. There's a little bit of that is in the air. Of it.
Sure.
But I've made it clear to the team, like, we have to be, at every step of the way, we have to be clear about what it is, because people can kind of get carried away with what they would see as an opportunity to be involved.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sort of road to exploitation.
That's actually something that's specifically weird about how Patreon works.
Patreon, that is, yeah, I think there's a lot of Patreon projects that are like that.
Yeah, like people will fund the game looking to like steer the game in a certain direction
yeah.
that they might want. And if they have the money to throw around in order to do that, it can be yeah. very enticing to like start appealing to that audience.
Well, when we were doing Dogpile, mm-hmm. You know, Peter suggested that we do a Game Found or a Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah.
And one of the natural rewards was get your dog as one of the cards in Dogpile.
Right.
And I was always a little bit against that mm-hmm. For similar reasons. But that is incredibly common
yeah.
and very sad. People love that. There's yeah. no people totally know what that is. There's a difference between like you know, paying for to walk on the set of a movie,
yeah,
and like versus being hired as a minor actor on a movie. It's right. like if you're outside that field, it's not exploiting your labor. It's actually you're outside that field, so
yeah.
it's different. But you know, your game is the same thing.
Yes,
there's a higher level tier where you can design a card in the game.
Yep,
or design a monster and like. That's essentially the sort of paying to work on the project.
Now,
but
we made it clear that we would take your concept and yeah. work with you to make it work, but it
yes.
needs to fit within
the You game. Always need those disclaimers.
Because like, otherwise people will be like, put, you know, random alien such and such thingy mabob that right. I like my OC.
Well, what you're going to get is someone like, please put my version of Pregnant Garfield in this game.
Yeah.
That's what you're going to get.
And well, we...
and you're going to have to find a way to work with that.
Yeah, yeah.
But that is, you're not asking people to pay to contribute labor.
Yeah.
It's the relationship is defined as like a fan relationship.
Right.
And so, but it is kind of can be a fine line.
Yes.
If you're a person who is, you know, you draw and you don't have a lot of connections and you feel that that's your way in to industry, like that's on you.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're given the expectation that that could be like something you could then put on a resume or something, then it starts to become troubling.
Right.
And that's just a huge risk for things like that. So
yeah.
I'm very mm-hmm. nervous about all of that stuff. And any kind of crowdfunding project, but Patreon more frequently.
Well, it's consistent amount of money, right? Like you're paying for something. Well, I guess you can do a donation once a. I don't exactly know how Patreon works in that.
So there's a couple you can configure it different ways.
Yeah,
right okay. now we just have monthly donations. We have two levels.
Okay.
One is you get access to the private channels on the Discord,
yeah.
and then the higher levels where you get access to all the pre-release demos.
Yeah,
and
but typically
stuff.
It's not a lump sum sort of thing. It's a you
can sign up for a month
monthly.
And quit.
Yeah,
you can sign up for a month and give more instead, and you can like engineer it.
Yeah.
Or as a person setting it up, you can say like this particular asset that we offer, you can pay for that one time.
Okay.
We don't have anything set up like that.
Okay.
But as we do actually have that on our Knights Games Club Patreon,
ah.
you can pay $5 to get pictures of Ellen's cats,
ooh.
Even if you're not a patron.
Mm.
But we did that as a joke.
Yeah.
But feel free to give us $5 and you get pictures of Ellen's cats.
Mm.
Ellen's dogs, I should say.
Yeah. Dogs. Yeah.
yeah. Yeah. We've toyed with the idea of like, well, we could take some of the pre-release material that we're doing and offer that as one-time payment. But
mm-hmm.
then I think we would probably want to get the publisher's permission explicitly for that.
Yeah.
Even though it's not that much different. Is there's, you know, what's technical and what's essential or practical or effectively
yeah.
this
mm-hmm.
or that. It's hairy. But like, you know, we have support from all around in terms of, yeah, the publishers, you know, just saying like, we know why you're doing this, why you need it, and don't worry about us making it complicated for you. So that's been really
yeah.
nice.
Yeah.
But we've wanted to avoid selling demos or things in advance, partly because, again, it'll just cannibalize, like, give us $20 later. We don't
yeah.
need
it
now,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
You know, but the folks who are supporting us and just universally, it's been really validating in a sense, especially as people are reacting to the work. That's part of the work that I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm feeling that personally.
Yeah.
But just people are like, I wish I could give more. And like, that makes me uncomfortable. But at the same time, like, I should be feeling good about that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
People are really excited for what they've seen of the project. That audience that's been part
yeah.
of the Discord all along, they've gotten to know us because we post in there occasionally,
mm-hmm.
little teases and stuff. We've been offering that.
That's part of the, I guess that's part of the thing that feels kind of scummy about like asking for money in this way,
yeah.
both Patreon and Kickstarter,
yeah.
is like the way that people are expressing their gratitude and appreciation for your thing is monetarily in a
yeah.
way that like feels bad. I guess. I can't come up with a better way than it feels.
Well, I mean, Patreon, it's like the word, you know, they are a patron.
Yes.
Right. Like that's they're not a customer.
Right.
Right. It is explicit to it. But like I was talking about with Kickstarter stuff, that is what it is.
Yes.
Technically and literally, and you can point to it and say,
mm-hmm.
but the culture is a little different.
Right.
It's
mm-hmm.
not their expectations are a little bit different, and you have to really carefully manage that.
But what I meant is, well, maybe you're kind of feeling and why you're trying to avoid making it feel as bad as possible is mm-hmm. that like this is the way that people are expressing their appreciation is by giving you money that they can use instead. For whatever it is that they need to do. Instead of like, Maybe you're not feeling that.
You're not wrong in the broadest sense.
I'm feeling that some.
But I feel, I mean, I've always made the argument that games should be more expensive.
Sure.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and games should be free at the library for mm-hmm. everyone to play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they should all cost $150. Like, or whatever. I mean, I'm exaggerating.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean? Like, the race to the bottom has destroyed this industry.
I agree.
It's led to every problem we have. Mm. Every single problem we have. You can always trace it back to the fact that we are a volume business and our unit sales are as cheap as we can possibly make it, which makes it so difficult. It requires the safest bets on the biggest teams with the largest budgets, which means that it leaves so many people out in the cold.
Yeah.
Yep.
It leaves so many different types of games that can't be made.
Yeah.
And so part of me is like, one of the reasons we probably have to do this Patreon is because we know we're not going to be able to sell the game for $50.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
If we knew we could,
then maybe.
And we could hold out until then I don't think we would feel the pressure as much.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so it is sort of uncomfortable in a sense to sort of like have people pay for, to support rather than just pay for the product. Like, I want to make a piece of work. I want you to look at it and say that's worth whatever it is that you're charging for it. Buy it and enjoy it.
Yeah.
Leave a good review, maybe.
Yeah.
You don't have to. It's fine. Like, I'm, and part of that is a sort of like influencer creatorization all art that I'm just, you know, I mean, we have a podcast. Like, we're bad at social media, but like, we're part of that in a sense.
We've been doing it,
But like, I don't ever, I don't like that. I don't like building an audience as an artist that way. It doesn't feel correct to me.
Sure.
So I have a lot of personal hangups, I think, with it. So just making sure that, like, we never lead people astray. We never let them assume things that, you know, just because it's easier, just let them think it.
Mm-hmm,
And so what that means is that I'm definitely going to be motivated to, you know, reward people's attention and contributions by participating in the Discord channels. And that's going to take time out of my day.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, I'm not going to be able to go to sleep if I don't put a little effort into that. Mm. But I should be working on the game all the time.
Yeah.
You know? It's
but that's
tricky.
Part of how being an indie developer works. Like, you have to put in some effort so people know what the game is. Even if you're not going out into the public, right? You have to put in some work to make the game publisher friendly.
Yeah.
So that, like, they can give you the money.
Wait, you don't have full-time marketers on your indie team? What's wrong with you?
I know, right?
Well, I guess what I mean is that is publisher work, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
But creators, you can't run a YouTube channel and then assign an employee to do all your audience engagement.
Right.
Because that breaks the model entirely.
Yeah.
The whole point of it is that sort of faux authenticity, direct contact with the people kind of thing.
Yeah.
That like, I mean, you can sort of hear it in my description, but like, I think all of that is fake. Mm. Like, it's fake in the sense that it's not what it appears to be. It is a real thing.
Yeah.
Right? Those relationships are, in a sense, real. They're just not what they appear to be.
Sure.
And I don't think that's conducive to good work or good art.
I'm agreeing with you. Yeah. I'm just saying that, like, you still have to do that the way that the industry works now. You still have to do that even if you're not, like, being public facing.
But in that case, that's something where if you're indie, then you can just put on your marketer hat, or you can, if you have a team large enough to assign that task to somebody.
That's true. But
then the work you're doing is marketing work.
That's true. But once you make a Patreon, that stuff is public, and so you have to present it. Or you have to take some time out of your day in order to present it in a way that
would, and I can't be like a humbug about it because like the thing is we've offered this and we have to make it, you know, I can't say like not for me, like because we set it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to be there for when people ask like, how do you use this tag in HTML?
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm the only one who knows.
Yeah.
So, like, I gotta be on the boards. I gotta explain to them because like, it would be an abdication. It would be, I would say, unethical for me to just like wash my hands of it. Like, you know, just because we need to work and we set the expectations that we're not going to be doing a lot of extra labor.
Right.
And so I'm curious how that will go. I may find that just extremely rewarding.
Yeah.
You know,
maybe.
Because this is what this kind of work, this kind of engagement is what I really want to do when the game is out.
Yeah.
You know, so just being able to do it now might be a production problem.
Yeah.
Like, maybe I'll love it.
That's possible. Yeah.
It's cool to see people excited. Mm-hmm. You know, when people saw someone solve Plox for the first time, that was a big moment.
Ooh.
Happened earlier today.
Cool.
Like, so it's, you know, it's fun to people going along and just the attitudes of spirits are high.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of poisoning it a little bit with my own thoughts. But
yeah,
it's all going great.
But you want to make sure you're doing it in a way that is ethical and right.
Yes, yes.
So I understand that.
Yeah. And I do want to talk about something we talked about before. We'll end here.
Yeah, okay.
But I want to talk about the actual money. So
yeah.
So Part-Time Hero, is as of recording time,
mm-hmm.
it's raised about $27,000.
Yeah.
And that's about 15% of its ask.
Yes.
And we feel pretty good about that.
Yeah.
Around the table.
Right now.
Yeah. We'll see. For the Patreon, we're just shy of $3,000 a month, from about 400 people.
Okay.
Which is pretty good for a Patreon. It's a testament to the audience that was already built,
yeah.
For Hypnospace Outlaw. But like with, Part-Time Hero, that money split the way we're splitting it, on the three main developers, and we have a little artist fund for,
yeah.
Outside work that we're commissioning.
Yeah.
That's not objectively that much money,
right?
You know,
yeah, exactly.
It doesn't actually, it doesn't turn the payments that I get for working on the project into a salary.
Yeah,
it's more of a bump than it should be, considered, you know, in terms of percentage, but yeah. It still ultimately doesn't add up to a full-time salary,
right?
And so we're still counting on, you know, games still got to get done, still got to get sold.
Yeah,
but it's really gratifying to see how much it is, because yeah. That's kind of it's more than we thought.
Yeah.
More than we thought it was going
to
be.
Yeah. I think that's been helpful to see, because, I mean, I don't know. I think part of it is, like, before the Kickstarter happened, I was like, this thing's just going to tank immediately. No one's going to see it.
Yeah.
Get 5% in 30 days. But, like, see, I don't know. I had to see it as negatively as possible, so that, like, when it got better, yeah. I'd feel a lot better. I don't necessarily feel as good as I was hoping, but.
Right. You got the stakes are so high.
The stakes are high.
Yeah. I don't have that same problem.
I suppose that's fair.
Yeah.
But seeing that the numbers that, like, 15 were already 15% of the way funded, and it hasn't even been a whole week yet, mm-hmm. like, that does feel good. That does feel like that my initial instinct is correct in that, like, I think people really wanted to see this game get made.
Yeah.
And I already knew that, and that's why we were showing it to all these publishers, because I would have thought that the publishers would also see that. Sometimes yeah. it's difficult because you don't really know what publishers are doing. They'll give you what to me feels like a flimsy reason as to why they didn't want to go ahead with this project.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of stuff that they're doing in the back end that, like, I don't know, and they're not going to disclose.
Yeah. They've already got two deck builders on deck, you know, to use a term.
Yeah.
Like, they're just,
and we just don't know that, because they're not going to tell us yeah. that, because it's none of our business.
They don't have a QA infrastructure to handle a lot of animation, you know, tickets. So
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They don't want to deal with that. You know what I mean? Right. There's just a million reasons that might be technical or otherwise.
Yeah. And they'll just tell you that, I don't know, your story wasn't great or something. And it's like, you know, this little flimsy, it feels like a flimsy reason.
Well, usually they'll just say we decided to pass, right?
They give you a little bit of a thing just to make you feel a little better,
but
it just makes it worse. Actually, it just makes you feel worse.
Yeah.
You're like, this is already good. Anyways.
Oh, see, I always felt like whenever we were pitching, they were always like, oh, we already have a life sim on the. Like,
that happens a lot of the time, too. And that feels okay to me,
yeah.
I guess. None of the reasons are ever going to feel great. But ultimately, what I'm trying to say is that, like, it helps to see that there is an audience for this game that does exist. It kind of just proves what my previous thinking already
yes,
on this game.
Yes.
I knew people wanted to see a Magical Girl game because mm-hmm. Magical Girls are popular. Not just because Magical Girls are popular, but they're also cool. So yeah. like this it's great to see that there's some support.
Yeah, this is going to sound like faint praise, but like
yeah.
when I saw it, I'm like, why wasn't this picked up by a bunch? It seems
right,
so
yeah.
it seems very mainstream.
It does. Yep.
You know, and like that's the faint praise I mean. Like it's and that's not how I intended, but
yeah,
it
no,
seemed like who wouldn't want this?
Yeah.
Like it just seems like there must be an enormous audience for this.
Yeah.
Even if they already have three things exactly like it, which they don't.
Yeah.
But like, even if they did, they'd still want it.
Right.
So like, who said no to this?
Yeah.
Weird.
That's exactly how you it know? Feels. So it just feels, it's nice to have a little bit of that vindication.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there are some positive notes to Kickstarter, Patreon, begging for money, I guess.
Yeah.
The way that we're describing.
Well, that's why we call this begging, because like, we yeah. just have these mixed feelings about it.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, we have to live in the world that exists,
mm-hmm.
right? And, you know, we also have to really be mindful of the fact that people who back, that emotional connection, as yep. much as it's dangerous, is real.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm probably too quick to, but we shouldn't be too quick to dismiss it, for its, you know, dangerous parts.
Yeah, for sure.
And so it's a way to build an audience, and the games need audiences,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. It's just weird to be part of the marketing at that level as opposed to just marketing the game.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which feels a little bit more above board, you know? And so it's just unusual.
Yeah. It's a different way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to adjust.
Yeah. And, you know, other teams have a lot of experience, and I think we don't.
Yeah.
Folks on your team do. So it's a learning mm-hmm. process as well.
Learning process.
Mm-hmm. And you're playing with live ammo. Right?
Wow.
Yes.
That's a good way of putting it.
That is yeah. a good way of putting it.
So we've been talking a lot, which yeah. is the thing we do on this program.
Uh-huh. It is a podcast.
It's generally the format. I don't know why you even asked about it.
Uh-huh.
But if you, dear listener, also want to do some talking, there's a place you can go, which is our Discord.
Yeah.
We have a channel in the Noble Robot Discord mm-hmm. for Discussing Nice Games Club. And you can get there by going to nicegames.club/discord. And, of course, there's the opportunity to flap your lips.
Yes.
Who would say no to that?
Right, right, right.
But what else? Why else would you want to be part of that?
You can have a conversation with other people on the clubhouse.
Yeah.
Or in the clubhouse. It's nice to be able to talk about with the community about certain topics that we've talked about. If you have experience, actually, with Patreon or Kickstarter, and you just want to talk about or rant about, like, your experiences, mm-hmm. the Discord is a great place to do that. I would love to hear what you have to say about it.
Yeah.
I'm curious to see how other campaigns have been going. And you can also talk to us, people in the clubhouse, Beth included. Yeah, you're on our Discord, yeah.
I think so.
Yeah.
You have to at me because I got lots of Discord.
That's fair.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can talk to all of us also.
And if you miss Ellen, Ellen's still in there sometimes.
It's true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She was actually probably one of the more active of us in the clubhouse.
Yeah.
In the past,
yeah, so yeah.
She will likely still be quite active.
But I would say the main value is like talking to other listeners because mm-hmm. one of the things mm-hmm. that I've been really gratified to see is people expanding on what we've talked about,
yes.
bringing their own experience, and then suddenly you check back in a couple hours or a few days later, and it's like talking about something totally different, but they yeah. got there from what they were listening to together.
Yeah,
and that's because they're engaging from their own perspectives in a way that, like, even our contributions to that conversation wouldn't have helped with. So,
yeah.
like, it's nice to see that it's a starting point. The show is a starting point for that conversation, and we hopefully provide a place to keep that going.
Yeah, absolutely. You can go to nicegames.club/discord and join the conversation.
All right, Steven, our therapy session went a little bit long in the last topic, and we shared it, but you've got a whole topic of your own.
Yes, we're quite changing gears, because this is just a game design conversation.
Yeah.
And not about the back-end business stuff.
Good.
Yeah. I'm tired of talking about this. This isn't
developer quality of life?
No.
Oh, thank goodness. I couldn't take another one like that.
I don't want to talk about that at all.
No, no, we're not doing that.
It's crummy. Move on.
Basically. I want to talk about quality of life in terms of game development.
Specifically, like QOL features.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think people have, people like use the term in a way that maybe isn't realistic to how it actually impacts games.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk about that because there was this article that I read that I really liked that described some of the little tiny tweaks that you oftentimes will do to improve a game, quote unquote improve a game, will oftentimes have a lot of ripple effects that you don't recognize until it's too late, I guess. Mm-hmm. You've already made the change. So I guess first thing we should do is define quality of life. The way that I'm talking about quality of life is just little changes you can make, tiny changes you make to make a game more approachable or friendly to play is oftentimes how people talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily like little tweaks to make the shader look better. Sometimes that's the case, though.
A lot of this is UX stuff.
Yes, a lot of it is UX stuff. Yes, exactly.
Whether it reads as UX or not, that's its implication.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to talk about it because I think, I think that we oftentimes will just talk about it, especially when gamers talk about it, they'll be like, this quality of life change would be so easy to implement.
Excellent impression.
That was good, yeah.
And, you know, it's not. Sometimes it is actually easy to make these changes.
Don't let them think that.
Yeah, you're right. Never mind, they're always hard.
Well, sometimes it's you don't want to make that choice.
Yes.
Right. So maybe they're like, wouldn't it be great if you could do this? Like, yes, and it would be easy, but
right.
you have these drawbacks you don't know about.
Right. In addition to that, sometimes these changes feel like they would improve the game.
Yeah.
Because it makes it easier for you to do a certain thing. But it can also have, like I said, it has ripple effects. It has little changes, not just even just like coding wise that would make it difficult to implement,
mm-hmm.
but also it can have effects to the game design and the feel of the game that like are really difficult to appreciate when you make those little tweaks. So like, for instance, Coyote Time, when you have an opportunity in the platformer to jump after you hit, after you leave the ground, when you're like walking off the platform or something like that, that often most platformers do that. Mm-hmm. Now, because like it's decided it's the quality of life change a lot of platformers having.
Yeah.
But it has affected the timing and understanding of like specific jumps in the game. It makes it difficult to truly understand if you're trying to make like a precision platformer, like a real hardcore one. Oftentimes, like the distance that you have to jump needs to be tuned. I'm going to say really precisely, but it's not necessarily accurate.
Well, it has to be that precise. I think you're now talking like a speedrunner.
Okay.
Because mm-hmm. the reason Coyote Time exists is so that you don't have to be so precise about the edge of a ledge.
Right, I know.
But with Coyote Time, most players will still, in their own head, try to jump at the edge of the ledge, not past it.
Yes.
Now, the speedrunners will try to jump past it, and they will just be back at the original problem.
Yeah.
Essentially. But so the life we're talking about is the life of the average player.
Yes. That I am trying to talk about it in that perspective. But I think it also affects how players approach a game, too. If the game is if the game is not as forgiving, then like the player will understand that, hopefully. Yeah. The player will understand that and like use that information to be more cautious about when they jump. I mean, where they jump.
Sure, sure.
And I think that like that's kind of a weak sauce argument against or towards quality of life. But I wanna, one of the examples that I really liked that I understood better because it was a fighting game thing.
Uh-huh. We need a theme song for when we just like fighting game corner.
Oh my gosh, yeah. And it would be FGC. That would be great because it would be fighting game community. Oh my gosh. I'll look into that now. but an example that I wanted to bring up that I think was really good in this article that we will link in the show notes is the fighting games have like, there's a little bit of buffer when you have the time to like put in your combos and things
mm-hmm.
That were not the case, you know, way back in arcade days. Way back. sorry.
You're not that young.
Yeah, I know.
I was like, Stephen, you've ever been to an arcade?
Yes. Jeez. So most games nowadays have a little bit like, you know, a 3 to 5 frame window in order to hit like your fancy combos, not fancy combos, but just like enough time to hit your supers or to just like do your basic bread and butter combos. Easy. Just
nodding over here. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Just the simple combos that you have that the game has as your move list.
Things. Yeah.
But that wasn't the case in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And so like a lot of the game has kind of morphed into being a lot more about frame data than it initially was.
Yeah.
Like people don't drop combos because the combos are so forgiving, and because people don't drop combos, it's expected if you make this mistake, you will take such and such damage. And so people start mm-hmm. like basically, it starts to become like a math game and less about like the frantic.
Because you assume it'll always be executed.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. If you can always hit your combos, then there's no reason to like take certain risks.
So this is a good
back
to what I was saying about the
okay
whose life is the quality for.
Yeah.
Because
I can already see where you're going with this.
Because but fighting games is a good example mm-hmm. because the distance between someone who starts getting interested in fighting games
yes.
and then obsessed with fighting games is a yes. lot is a shorter leap.
Yeah.
And the developers of fighting games tend to cater more to that audience anyway.
Yes.
So I'm actually curious that this is happening.
Uh-huh.
But I could see that making a lot of sense for there. But when you say that you expect to hit all the combos, as a designer, if I was making that system, I wouldn't actually expect that.
Okay.
Right? Because I'm not expecting the only people to play my game to be the hardcore obsessives.
Right. But
in fighting games, that's kind of true.
Yes. Not just that, but like people expect to be able to hit all the combos. And so like they will... I think a lot of times people will like go into a new fighting game now and like look at the frame data before they've even touched the game
sure.
in a way that I find troubling. Cause it's like, you should figure out which character you like to play before you figure out if this frame, if this game or this attack is safe or not or whatever. But I think that like it's sort of changed. So like you have to look at the Wikipedia.
I have a solution to all this.
Okay.
And then no one's going to like it.
Okay.
No, everyone's going to hate it.
Stop making fighting games?
No, that buffer,
uh-huh.
it randomizes between 3 and 7 frames every time it's entered. It's just impossible. So you just have to play the game normally. You have to try to hit your combos.
Yeah.
And don't worry about any of that other nonsense.
Yeah.
Because there's no way to actually track it. That's my solution, and I can't imagine anybody wanting that.
Yeah, that seems
because they want the data.
Yeah,
right. That's the culture.
Yeah, they want to be able to hit their combo.
Yeah, but the goal of that is not to give that data to people.
Right.
The goal is to just make it a little bit more forgiving, so that it's a little bit less needing.
Oh, precision. I see. So every time you do an attack, sometimes it just takes a little longer to.
Well, you just don't know how big the buffer is, so mm-hmm. Don't aim for the buffer. Aim for the frame you want.
Yeah.
And then if you miss the frame, you might get it sometimes. You might not other times.
Well, that's
if I'm a casual player, yeah. that's a really good feeling.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to be going for the frame perfect. I'm going to get it sometimes because I actually do.
Yeah.
I'm going to get it sometimes because the buffer was nice.
Yeah.
And I'm going to miss it sometimes because I missed it. I'm going to miss it sometimes because the buffer was just tight that time. Mm-hmm. I'm never going to know, and that's fine. But if I'm obsessed, I'm going to hate every every way that works because I want to know exactly so I know and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. I mean, in the past, when you didn't have buffer, that's basically what would happen.
That's kind of what I'm saying. You're saying you would want to return to that kind of play.
I'm not necessarily saying that the way that buffer time works now is even bad. I'm just saying that is how the games have morphed.
Okay.
In a way that
seemed like you didn't like that turn.
I mean, I kind of like that. I don't necessarily like the way that frame data has encompassed a lot of how fighting games are.
Well, I think, I mean, I'm getting off task, off track, because it's easy when it's fighting games.
Yes.
But
it's true.
But your larger point is that it was intended as a quality of life feature, and it's something else now.
Yes.
And that happens not infrequently and not just in fighting games.
Yes. Yeah, there was an example of a real-time strategy game. The real-time strategy game, and StarCraft.
Mm-hmm.
StarCraft 2 changed from how StarCraft worked that I didn't understand because I don't play real-time strategy games as much. But like basically they made it a little bit easier to approach how StarCraft worked in StarCraft 2. And it caused like, I guess, ball of death sort of strategies where you could just have giant mobs going after other giant mobs.
Yeah, like those mobile games that don't exist.
Yeah, exactly like those. So I wanted to talk about the fighting game one because when I understood.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that necessarily listeners might. Oh, yeah, I'm sure, Lee, I've talked enough about fighting games that y'all understood what the heck I was talking about. Even Mark understood it, so that should be enough. But I'm actually curious if there are quality of life changes that you felt in like sequels or commonly seen in other in genres of games that have effects that you that I think developers didn't necessarily realize, but like seemed like a good idea at the time. That's kind of I'm kind of putting y'all on the spot if there are any that are like that. But I guess actually let me back up.
Yeah.
What is an example of quality of life change that you could think of in another game?
Well, the one when you were starting to ask this question, I was thinking of just an example.
Oh, okay,
then
cool.
Then you narrowed it, and I was like, would this work? And it kind of does, when you get hit in a platformer or in a lot of other types of games, like a beat 'em up, you get that invisibility flash.
Right.
Or invisibility, rather.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where you're just like, okay, I got hit. I got a minute to recompose.
Yeah.
Right. And that's pretty classic.
Yeah.
That I think has not been fully corrupted, but often, especially in speedrunning, it's called like damage boost.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Where you use that to
Get past an obstacle.
Like, I'm going to get hit by this first enemy so that I can just run past the next four.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Which is like, that's cool. I think that works for speedrunners as a fun meta tactic, but I don't think it's poisoned the mind of the average gamer the way I would worry that some of those fighting game things have.
Yeah.
But I doubt it was intended to be something that could be used, you know, in a way to advantageously.
Yeah.
Right? Just more like to prevent unfair bad outcomes was the thing.
Right.
And that's mostly true, but I don't think it was ever intended to be something you could exploit.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of games, it's very easily exploitable.
That's actually interesting that, like, a lot of the times I'm thinking about, like, how things have changed there with respect to, like, speedrunners.
Yeah.
I think it has affected how casual people play this, but I think a lot of the examples that were in this article I was talking about do tend to be about like competitive games where people are primed to be more, they care more about like how the game is approached.
Yeah.
Or how they approach the game. I don't know.
Beth, you got one?
Well, so I like to brag about the quality of life in Verdant Skies.
Yes.
Okay.
I hate farming games where you gotta equip your pitchfork, equip your shovel, equip your whatever.
Yeah.
So, like, just taking that out and having the what you interact with directly, like, just work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I love that.
Context, yeah.
That was hard to implement, though.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you can do more than one thing.
Right.
Right. See, that's the thing. A quality of life feature like that pens in your design a little bit,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you can't have all the flexibility of many different tools for many different jobs.
Yes. So
that, sometimes those are hard choices to make.
And that's what I like about this article that you're sharing the thing. There's the paragraph that says, why are we optimizing mechanics to the point that they're basically gone from the game? Things stop being about quality of life and become questions of genuine design goals. What's the point of intentionally introducing complications only to eventually sand over? We get modern Metroidvanias with color-coded blocks and color-coded attacks with color-coded map icons because of quality of life. But then all we do is reduce the games to a checklist.
Yeah.
Have we replaced the fantasy of exploration with busy work? Is that really a higher quality of life? And that just gave me like this whole like existential crisis of like, what kind of games am I making? Are they really games? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, it's just like, that's a really good point. Like, what is the design goals? And I think about the games that like my son's friends play.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, I would have hated that game as a kid.
Yeah.
That like, no wonder kids these days can't sit still, can't focus, don't want to learn hard things, don't want to do hard things. Like, everything is so easy. It's been like all of the exploration, all of the thinking has been removed. Like when I sit down with Gabe and I'm like, well, how would you solve this problem? And like, he'll take a lot longer than I would have at eight. Like, because I played like Zelda without,
right.
When I tell them like we had books to help us when we got stuck, but you had to go and buy them at a store. Like people look at me like I'm crazy. These like 15-year-old kids or whatever. But it's like, it's crazy because that's how it was. Yeah. Like we had to use our brains to solve the problems that the developers made. And there are games that I walked away from for days because I was so frustrated.
Yeah.
And I don't see that in a lot of the things that are designed for like younger kids these days.
I mean, to circle back to the depressing topics we talked about earlier, is like a game that is so hard that people walk away from, like you're going to hear about that on TikTok.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you just didn't before, so it wouldn't, so it didn't impact the design of those things.
Right.
But now that kind of, that notion, what looks good, you don't want to see someone fail 30 times in a row in an Instagram story.
Yeah.
Right.
But like that would be, but that's good design.
That's great design.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, for a particular type of game.
Right. Yeah.
And so when you think about quality of life, you want to think about things that like sand away friction that was not intended.
Yeah.
Or does not contribute to the pillars of your design. But I think a lot of times, especially the ones you get from the entitled gamers, the suggestions, tend to be like, I would have an easier time if you did this. Like, but that's not what I'm...
That's not what we're trying to do.
Not what I sold you.
Yeah, exactly.
This is a game. It's a challenge.
Yeah.
I appreciate you bringing it back to actually bringing up Verdant Sky as an example. Because, I think Mark was right in that, like, it does affect, like, how you can build things together. It's difficult. It's not as easy as to think to just, like, press a button and do whatever is available there because, like, you can't have things stacked upon one another.
Right. Because
you only have one tool.
It doesn't help the player to, like, give them the agency to choose whichever tool for whichever job when most of the time there's one tool for one job.
Yeah.
It doesn't serve your design to add that friction.
Right.
So let's clear out what we can from it.
Yeah.
But then also then you have to think about when like then it also means that you can't design in a way that would add the kind of friction because then you'd have to take it away.
It does shape it does shape how the game has to be made.
Yeah.
Well, and that's why those amazing water hoses exist. I don't know if you guys have seen those water hoses. Andy's so proud of
them. Dear listener,
that.
It's one of the headline features of Verdant Sky. It's very cool.
Because if you don't pick up the watering hose, like because you can fertilize the dirt. Mm-hmm. So like if you're not holding the water hose, like you can't have a watering can and fertilizer and like right click, left click. Like, so it was like watering hose. Yes. Yeah. And then if you walk up, you can fertilize, right? Like,
and that's the UX of it is like, how do you communicate and how do you mechanize those sorts of things and make it so that it becomes task after task instead of juggling a bunch of things.
Yeah.
And then it becomes a satisfying sequence of events
mm-hmm.
that also is a sort of like figuring out how to do it. And because games like Verdant Skies are really, I mean, it is about busy work, but that is the positive experience of playing those games, right?
Sometimes that makes the game
feel... It's a cozy
game. Yeah, but sometimes that makes the game feel like you're living in it and not just like the game caters to whatever you want it in every given time, right?
But you want to remove the friction that makes it like your real life busy work, which
right.
is, you know what, it still needs to feel enjoyable and satisfying to do
right. mm-hmm.
and be a puzzle sometimes when it needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, it's a very complicated, delicate matrix of concepts that is very hard to do. And I think Verdant Skies does a really good job of it.
Oh, thanks. That wasn't a plug on purpose, but like that's the game I know.
Available on Steam
like, the
today.
Quality
folks.
Of life we'll stuff. Put that in the show notes.
Look, we plugged our stuff. You could plug your yeah. stuff. It's
I mean,
fine.
It's been out for a while.
Yeah, well, you can get a little bit of a kickback still.
It's well loved by mm-hmm. its players.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
One. Yeah.
It's true.
I think we've probably plugged it before when you've been on the show, but
probably because I've been on the show a lot.
Yeah. Whatever. You're a guest host. You get to.
That's why I said it's not actually a plug. It's just those are the mechanics I know and
we're,
I can understand.
We're plugging it. Steven and I
yes,
are plugging.
Okay. We are. Yes.
You're not violating the.
Okay. Good.
The contract listeners.
Yeah.
Because I was trying to think of a game that I didn't make that I could like talk really in depth about, like, but I can't.
That's just, how good the like, quality of life is in Verdant Skies, people.
But I really appreciated that example because, like, I kept thinking of really hardcore stuff. And I was like, oh, is quality of life only important for hardcore players? And I'm like, no, that's not true. It impacts everything.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the other thing, too, is, like, I was thinking when you were talking about the frame delay, it's like, does that add accessibility to the fighting game community?
It does, right? Like, it has improved things.
Yep.
Yeah.
Like, important in real ways. That is, like, that's why I wasn't trying to argue against it. I like a certain way of it, but, like, mm-hmm. I like that, like, you can't just rely on your combos always working, but like at the same time, it does make it more approachable for people who maybe have a hard time hitting the buttons at a certain time or with particular timing.
Yeah.
So it is valuable to have those things. But I just think it's more, it requires more thought than just being like, this would make it easier.
Right.
So we should add it.
There's unintended consequences. It shifts the focus of where the challenge is, especially in a competitive game.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it adds some accessibility, but then there are people then who can be more precise, and then it's more complicated. Not only do you have to have perfect inputs, but you also have to have like more encyclopedic knowledge.
Yes.
And then the upshot is perhaps less accessible.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
And that's not by design, but that's sometimes the result.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just think it's frustrating that you have to go to a wiki to learn how to play a game now.
yeah, that's
really annoying.
I think it's interesting you're talking about. There's the dichotomy of games that the trends you're both talking about. It's like games are way, way too easy now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And like, you know, Steven, not you, but we're the Nintendo generation.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah. So, old school.
Right, right. Like, Nintendo hard was not a meme. It was just video games.
Yeah.
And so I don't have a particular love for that concept, I will say. So I'm not going to speak out in that old-timer notion. But what I mean to say is that games really are very much more walkthroughable, and that is where people expect their entertainment. And, like, I mean, that's, like, it. There's the old man argument is everything's a walking simulator now, even hardcore games.
Mm.
And that may or there's nothing wrong with that as a goal, but I don't think that's what people think the goals are.
Yeah.
They accidentally do that because of the trends and those sorts of things. But on the other side, Steve, what you're talking about is the path to become an expert in a game is much steeper than it used to be.
Yes.
Because it's so easy to get pretty good at most games.
Yeah.
And so in order to have an elite either competitively or even just like high score wise in other games, because everyone has shared knowledge, and you know it's not just rumors on the playground anymore.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
So it means that actually you have to make that upper tier so much harder to get into now.
Yeah.
Otherwise, people just exhaust themselves with the experience and they're done with it forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you have pulls at both ends in a weird way.
Yeah.
I think the lesson for indie gamers or indie developers, I should say.
Yeah.
Is when you think about when you're putting together your first player controllers or your platforming systems or whatever things you're doing, you will quickly be bereft of quality of life features.
Yeah.
And then you will play test it and you'll wonder why it's so hard for people to do.
Yeah.
And so we're talking a lot about like the pitfalls and at the upper ends of the high-end polished games where they can go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But the other side of this really is like, you know, you we'll start with no quality of life features and you won't even know it.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And like identifying what it is to polish or make easier, whether that's a matter of like what information is provided to the player so that they understand controls better. Like maybe this system needs to be modified or maybe needs to adapt as the game progresses. Because I've seen a lot of indie games that are so obtuse, and then they're fully explained to you, and then they make perfect sense.
Well, Mark, it's art. Sorry, I couldn't resist.
But getting from A to B on that is a challenge, and
mm-hmm.
and sometimes the quality of life is not actually changing any mechanics. Sometimes it's about presentation.
That's true,
right? And that it's there's not one tactic,
right?
All the examples we had are expressed differently with different tools.
Yep.
Yes.
So it's a hard topic to nail down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So sorry, everybody.
Once again, Nice Games Club cannot solve all of your problems.
All
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.fudge. One more time.
You start with the and if.
Okay.
Only the most authentic bloopers.